Yes, indeedy. Thank you, John. John Faddis with Into the Faddisphere. This is his signature way of playing the trumpet, but it seems so appropriate today. He's screaming for all of us. And I do appreciate that. That's from the title track of his Into the Faddisphere from 1989. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. And let's scream into the fatosphere together today. There's so many stories that we are trying our best to catch up with, but lots of things are happening all over the place. And it is a good idea to just at least touch on them. We could always come back to them again later, but a lot is going on. So 888-874-4888. I will give you a hint, give you a short description of a news headline that I think requires a lot more exploration so that it makes sense. But bear in mind that a lot of these stories are still evolving. But even so, we see the pattern of how the media are covering these issues and news stories, and why we have to be on point, why we have to be alert, because there's so many different agendas at play. The first one I want to talk about is the testimony today in court, well, in a court of law as they see it, by Michael Cohen, who was a former advisor to President Donald J. Trump. Some pretty interesting things were said, but what do you think, based if you've followed the testimony so far, what do you think is the most significant thing that has happened so far? What is most significant about the testimony in Congress today? 888-874-4888. The other story that you may want to talk a bit about is history being made or already being made in Chicago with the likelihood of the election of Chicago's first African American mayor, female. That will be confirmed because now we have two finalists out of a field of 14 candidates. It was so crowded. But finally, it came down to two women, a former federal prosecutor, Lori Lightfoot, who got 17.5% of the vote, and Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle. With 16% of the vote, they were the finalists, and now, come April 2nd, they face each other in the final vote that will determine the winner in the mayoral race. But even no matter how it goes, the winner will be an African American female mayor. What do you think about that? 888-874-4888. We're kind of moving a little fast today because I want to get as many people as possible participating. Henry from Chicago, almost on cue.
How you doing, you Trace?
Okay. So, how you feel about the events happening in your town?
Okay, I want to ask you this. Now that we have two black females who are running for Chicago, which guarantees the first black female mayor of Chicago. As an outsider, what do you think about black voters in Chicago when it comes to this?
You know, I don't look at it that way about the voters per se. I think it was a skimpy showing, just the same. A race this important to replace Rahm Emanuel and all the things associated with Emanuel and to bring in a new day, I thought it would have excited the voters a lot more. But this was not indicative. The turnout was not indicative of people having, a lot of enthusiasm about voting.
Okay. Well, just to inform you and the Lead Stories listeners, neither one of these candidates took any wards that were majority black. So I just want to put that out there for the public.
I'll save that hint for another story we will be talking about today, but continue.
Okay, all right. So it's a very interesting development here, because the one thing is Lori Lightfoot, who is one of the candidates, I think I mentioned this yesterday, that there were 14 candidates for mayor. She's one right. That isn't exactly a politician. This will be her first run at a political office. However, she has been appointed to different positions. She was appointed by Rahm Emanuel for the Police Accountability Board review. Now, you got Toni Preckwinkle, who is the seasoned, she's basically the politician. She is currently the Cook County Board President. She was a alderman in the 4th Ward, so she knows her way around the block. She's more tied into the machine than Lori is, but the thing is that Lori has ties to the machine as well. It's just not, hasn't been, elected to a public office yet. So it's an interesting race, but, I just want to let people know that neither of these candidates did get in the black wards, because the one guy who majority of the black people who did vote, like you mentioned, there was a low voter turnout. The majority of the black people who did vote was Willie Wilson, who was a philanthropist. He's a self-made millionaire, and basically he kind of financed his own campaign. So he came in fourth. The surprise was actually Bill Daley, who came in third. He is the brother of Richard Daley, the previous mayor before Rahm Emanuel, who was mayor of Chicago for 20 years. And that's the one thing that I think might be a small light in this. Chicago didn't want to see another Daley ruling the city. So
the end of the Daley dynasty?
The end of the Daley dynasty. And he put out the most money out there. But I think, to kind of cap this off, I think most of the candidates relied on basically media to get their word out there. Lori was basically one of the few who did the groundwork to get, her base to vote. And basically her base was kind of like the North Side and also LGBTQ voters, because she is an openly gay person. So she got her base to vote, and that's what this election came out to be. It's whoever political base is turning out to vote, they're going to get that, get one of those spots for the runoff.
Well, it's also, I'd like to know your thoughts about the machine, the Democratic Party machine. What happened to it?
The machine is actually still alive, even though the mayor's race. Well, depending on if Toni Preckwinkle gets it, because I think she's a machine politician. But the machine is actually still breathing. It's on life support, but it's still breathing. There were a couple of automatic races of machine guys who lost. However, I want to say this. The guy who I've been previously talking about, Mr. Alderman Ed Burke, won his ward in yesterday's election, even though there are federal charges hanging over his head, with a majority Latino population in his ward. Now, he ran against two Latino politicians, and he still won. So the machine is still alive. It's hanging on, but it's still alive.
Okay. Well, Henry, thank you so much for that short tour of the election yesterday and what we need to keep in mind come April 2nd, when the final race is going to be run to determine who will get the big prize. We'll see. But thanks. That was an overview. I appreciate it. Thank you. 888-874-4888. Now, who is going to tell us what was significant about the testimony today of Michael Cohen? Donald Trump's former right-hand man. He was known as the fixer, the guy who would carry out all kinds of instructions given to him that we still don't know what he was instructed to do. Not totally. We know that he, of course, was implicated in attempting to pay off a lady, a very generous lady. But that's not all. There was something very, very significant about his testimony today. Did you spot it? It was just so glaring. But what was interesting was the media didn't pick up on it. They didn't even pick up on it. And yet it was staring them in the face. What was it? That's what I want to know. If you spotted it. And if you spotted it, please tell us what how you interpret that. You see, people take news, especially reporters these days. They cover the painfully obvious. And a lot of what ends up as reports are really the literal event, what people literally said, leaving very little to interpretation, especially if the situation is a bit dicey. This is one of those cases where you have the president's former chief advisor and his lawyer, actually. So he's a prized witness. And I was expecting that he would serve as an extraordinarily important witness. What did you, that's all I'm going to say. I'm not going to go any deeper than that, but I've given you enough hints. What was most significant about his testimony today? It was expected. This comes after he got snagged by the Mueller Commission, which is looking into, which has been looking into Trump's business affairs. And he got snagged into it, got convicted, and he's facing a jail term, which is one thing. But this testimony today, especially since we had indications from him that he was going to take the path less followed. He was going to follow his own convictions. He was going to be straight up, and he was going to answer the questions accordingly. What happened if you happen to have checked into the coverage of this trial or this testimony today? How did this actually play out finally? Chris from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Peace, Patrice. Love always, and peace to the family.
Thank you. Thank you. And same to you. So what's this big thing that I noticed?
Well, the thing that struck me most was the fact that Cohen said that at no point did they believe that they were actually going to win the election, that it was a matter of self-promotion, and that he had, and that the President Trump had no allegiance necessarily to the country itself. That's what stuck out to me.
Why did that stick out to you?
What is the purpose of having elections for the President of the United States in terms of this so-called American dream, where you perceive that the elected officials actually put the country's needs, wants, desires, and beliefs before their own? And when that doesn't happen, that makes you question the entire system. Or should make you question the entire system.
Do you think that he was hinting that Trump, as a presidential candidate, saw an opportunity to, because he was well-funded, he had a vigorous political base to support him, and the Democrats were kind of splintered. They didn't seem to have a congealed effort going. And conditions were ripe for him to get involved, but getting involved, I think you've made a very important point there, and that is that this is a president who did not become involved in the contest for the country's sake, but saw an opportunity to score a win, and he went after it, and in fact, it worked out. Even though it was a long shot, it worked out. What did you consider, how much of it did you watch today?
I didn't watch any of it. I actually listened to it in my travels through the day, through the city. And so I did listen to his entire testimony. Well, his opening statements, and then about 20 minutes of the back and forth with the particular representatives. And once it went to...
Was there anything that struck you as particularly interesting in the back and forth?
In the back and forth with the Republicans per se. I'll speak specifically to the Republicans because they were most outstanding with the fact that it was a matter of disregarding his very important and relevant issues and contributions to the dialogue about this particular president. It was more about discrediting him as a liar and a liar. And so I am very much not a fan of anyone who would go along with the particular machinations of this Trump guy as a New Yorker who has 45 years of dealing with this Trump thing. I do give him credit for speaking and actually standing there and being willing. You know, you can take it with a grain of salt. But he stood there.
Let me ask you this, and see how you react to it. Well, yes. The questions asked of this young man, Michael Cohen, were the questions asked of him. The kinds of questions you expect a body of this level and this this type that's your view?
In no way whatsoever. It was embarrassing, actually. It was high school lunch table back and forth. It was just disgusting.
It was embarrassing. If this is the
goes out to the world.
This is the issue. So the country is waiting, anticipating a throwdown a dogfight.
Mm-hmm.
Because if there is any time to actually get their man, and that is Donald Trump,
mm-hmm.
this is the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they asked these silly questions that had nothing to do with the main subject of Donald Trump.
Absolutely.
Now, how are we supposed to interpret this?
Right wing, left wing, same bird.
You know, it is so pathetic. What we put up with in this country.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You listen to the questions, because supposedly out of this testimony, and he went in there, Cohen, went there to deliver the kind of testimony that would actually make it so much easier for the members of Congress to take the next move. It didn't happen. At least not from my perspective, you saying the same thing.
Yes,
the quality of the questions, you described it as embarrassing, and I can't think of a more appropriate word. These people were embarrassing. Embarrassing. So you solved a great mystery.
I thank you.
You solved a great mystery. Thanks so much for your call today.
Always
888-874-4888 is the number to call. Let's see what we have in store. The next issue that I wanted to raise and get your take on it is that while all of this is going on, we have the president and his sidekick, Vice President, both doing their level best to start a war in Venezuela. And we're not getting very much in the way of reaction, sane reaction, in the United States, nor among the U.S. allies. How do you read the situation? We have it getting closer and closer every day to out-and-out warfare. We talked about the fact that from the beginning, the president had taken a position that President Maduro should be removed by force if necessary. Of course, the president says, well, of course, you know, we hope not by force, but he's got to go. And then we have the religious man who is dedicated to all things fair and good saying, while in Colombia, next door to Venezuela, saying that President Maduro must go. And he said, we are 100% behind the opposition, the people seeking to throw him out of office. What is your thought about the conduct of a head of state and a vice president stoking the fires of civil war in another country? What do you think about the way this president has conducted himself with regard to Venezuela and continues to conduct himself with respect to Venezuela? And the vice president as well. Why is it that this issue has not gathered the attention, the kind of attention in Congress that it ought to? Why is everybody so calm about it? Could you figure it out? Is there a reason that on the brink of war, stoked by the United States, the pressure to bring the president, the legitimately elected president of a country, bring him down, him and his administration, to bring them down, to lay hold of their assets, which of course, we know as oil. But beyond that, to demonstrate and to encourage the same kind of outcome in other Central and South American countries. This is the whole thing. Venezuela is supposed to serve as a template for what the Trump administration's vision, its vision for Central and South America, which is clear the decks of anybody we don't like, as he would say, assuming that the we includes the people of the United States. Just clear the decks and let's get on with a new kind of government all throughout the region. Put people out of office if you don't like them. We will give you the help. We will send you the soldiers. We will militarize your country for you. We will send you weapons. And, you know, you can take charge of the small matters of, you know, the civil war. And then we'll come in at an appropriate time and we will clear the decks completely for you. And you will be a loyal and true friend to the United States, allowing the United States to do whatever it wants to do in and with your country. We have not heard howls of protest here in the United States. Could you figure out why this reaction, that there's such calm here about this issue, when right in our backyard, we have unfolding a monumental crisis? How could this be? How could this be the case? Or do you think it is the case to begin with? 888-874-4888. You're a little slow on the draw today. What's going on? We are catching up on headlines. We're catching up on headlines. The latest move by the United States is to try to stop, get aid, humanitarian help across the border of Venezuela. But as Russia has said, and as China has said, they see it as a pretext. This humanitarian aid will also possibly contain guns and weapons to the people who want to throw Maduro out of office. And they have said out loud that they are not in favor of this kind of, quote, humanitarian help. So they are willing, of course, to help. But they are suggesting that people do not take this kind of humanitarian help because it really is a ruse for weapons, smuggling weapons into Venezuela to arm the people. Lisa, what are you thinking?
Hi, Utrice. How are you?
Fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm good. Well, to me, this is the biggest story that we should be listening to and paying attention to. I think as a country, we tend not to be concerned with foreign policy. Part of it is that that's not what the mainstream media ever covers. We're not supposed to ask about it. You know, we're not supposed to know what's going on in other countries. And this is not just Trump's vision. This is Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats' vision. And even Bernie Sanders has come out against Maduro. Now, I worked for his campaign. I spent more time on the Bernie Sanders campaign than any other that I've ever been involved in. I will not support him if he doesn't turn around and change his views on foreign policy and our interventions everywhere, not speaking up more about Israel. So, I mean, I have a lot more I could say, but this is also a racist right-wing attempted coup. You know, we want to put in the white elites of Venezuela. The majority of brown people there support Maduro. So, and of course, I mean, I think everyone in your audience knows that this has nothing to do with the people of Venezuela or caring about them. I don't know why people are not outraged. I just see that when it comes to foreign policy, we don't tend to become involved, or we hear what the mainstream media has to say, and we buy it. I mean, what do you think?
No, I agree with you wholeheartedly on that point. What is very scary is that media organizations, the ones that we used to think were more liberal-minded or left-leaning than they are, but they're just reporting the so-called violence occurring in Venezuela as people try to fight back against incursion by the forces that are seeking to take Maduro out. But here in the United States, we're not seeing the kind of concern, or maybe I'm misreading the whole thing, the kind of concern. This is, to me, a major, major story on several fronts. You have a president, and we know how he's like a gunslinger, and he decided, hey, I need my own little war, and let's go squash this bug called Venezuela and just take the country. Just take the country and everything we find useful in it. And it's going over well, because the resistance to it just simply doesn't seem to be there. So,
well,
I'm asking, is something wrong with, is this something wrong with us? Or
I think there is something wrong with us. I do, however, think that we might have a better outcome than you think, because I think they thought this would be a very easy thing to accomplish, and that the military would, would defect and go against Maduro. That hasn't happened. There's been a lot of meetings in the UN. Jorge Arreaza, the foreign minister in Venezuela, spoke yesterday. And most countries of the world are on the side of Maduro. We're just not hearing about that. So I think part of the problem is that people still watch. Media like MSNBC, CNN, they read the New York Times. I mean, I think people in my age group, and I'll be 65 in August, they still believe in these, that what they're hearing is the truth. NPR, it's not the truth. I mean, I was so upset on my way home from a trip a couple of weeks ago, and I heard Michelle Martin on a Sunday evening talk about Venezuela, and she was just saying things that weren't true. So that's part of the problem.
What do you think, Lisa, is kind of holding things together, even on a thin thread, that the intended force of the United States and its allies against Maduro has not yet been unleashed? What do you think is preventing it, or do you think that eventually it will?
Well, I hope not, but I think there is backlash. I think that it's not going the way they had anticipated, but you're not seeing all the protests here. However, I don't really know what happened on February 23rd. I mean, there were lots of protests planned in the United States. I just don't know if they actually occurred or how large they were. I listened to Black Agenda Radio, and Ajamu Baraka was speaking about this issue, and he is part of the Black Alliance for Peace, and I know that he planned a lot of, you know, for a lot of protests, and you could go online and see where things were happening in your area. But I don't really know what to do, except I think I did mention I think everyone should call their representatives and speak out about how they feel. But this is what we do everywhere. But I think that it's more obvious this time to most people. Maybe not to most Americans. I don't know.
Well, let's, you know, of course we maintain some surveillance of what's going on in Venezuela, because it is really awful. From so many angles, it's bad, very bad policy. And it is outrageous that Congress has not moved in a direction to suggest that they have any disagreement with the way
Trump
is handling things.
I don't think they do. I don't think they disagree. This is our imperialist policy all over the world, and I just assume that it has to do with, you know, controlling governments that are doing things for their people. I mean, everyone should know that Chavez and Maduro finally got their people out of poverty, that the money from the oil finally was used for people. They had these misiones where they had money for education and health care that they had not had before Chavez was elected, and that everything we're hearing is just not true. You know, and the other thing is that Americans don't seem to notice when we are placing sanctions against a country. I mean, that is economic warfare.
It is.
You know, we're causing the country to be in poverty. I'm not saying that Maduro's perfect, but
well, he is contending that he's perfect any more than Donald Trump is perfect, and yet he has 100% control of the country. But the fact is that what should bother people more than anything else is that this man is a duly elected president of his country. And there is this insistence by the U.S. government, by the president of the United States and his minions, to just remove the people's choice.
But you know, do most people know that? Does everybody know that there was an election in May of 2018 and that he won by 4 million votes, and that, you know, international observers were there? And,
yes.
You know, sometimes I wonder. I mean, if people know that.
Yes, we talked about it. And this is what was so outrageous about the conduct of the United States, that even at the international level, we don't see very much resistance. We don't see people saying, hey, what are you trying to do here? Create another Vietnam?
Yes.
And
well,
certainly if they did, Mr. Trump is not going to send his precious sons to fight.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I'm saying if there is a war created, I doubt Donald Trump will send his sons to fight. He didn't go.
I don't think so.
thank you very much, Lisa. Thank you so much for your call today.
Okay, thank you.
Really appreciate it. Patricia, you're on the air from New York.
Good afternoon, Eutrecia, and good afternoon to the PRN family. I just want to tag on to the previous caller, because I think we're talking about just a pure lack of information, not only in this country, but also throughout Latin America. So, for example, I guess about 2 or 3 days ago, Mr. Ramos, who is a reporter from Univision, He and about six of his colleagues were supposedly detained by Maduro. They were in the middle of an interview, and I watched some Spanish language coverage because I speak and understand Spanish. And so what happened was Maduro had consented to an interview by Mr. Ramos, and they were in the middle of the interview, and Mr. Ramos asked him to comment on a video that Mr. Ramos proceeded to show him. And the video was about people in the street who were literally eating garbage out of a sanitation truck that was collecting the garbage on the street. And you saw the people literally, the truck had stopped on the street to collect the garbage. So while this truck was stationary, people had literally gone into the garbage in the sanitation truck and was picking out food. And so, of course, Mr. Ramos or whomever was asking the questions, you didn't really see the person who was asking questions in the background, asked them, you know, don't you realize that this is garbage you're taking out of the garbage truck? And, of course, the people responded, yes, but we're hungry, we're starving, and we have no other option. If that's what you project as the state of people in Venezuela to the outside world, then the normal human response would be that there's something wrong with the government, and that whoever the head of this government is must go. So it's hard for people to refute what they're seeing as evidence of the state of Venezuelan people when you show a video of that nature.
But they should also keep in mind that this is not the first such type of attack against Venezuela. Hugo Chavez, I mean, he was beaten up and battered all day, every single day. There was nothing good about Chavez, except that the people appreciated that he was the president of their country and that he did so much to improve conditions within Venezuela. So this is a massive propaganda campaign, and it is intended to provoke. This is the thing. I think Trump is hesitating a little bit because the generals are having a rough time sanctioning and obeying the commander-in-chief's intended plan to order them into war. And they don't see a reason for it. So in a sense, I'm thinking, I have no proof of it, but I'm thinking that what is delaying what would be the inevitable is that you still have some military people who are keeping Trump in check. He doesn't have any solid reason to just unilaterally go to war against Venezuela. And if he does, we would see some disagreement in the military here, the higher ups in the military. This is not the kind of war they want to fight or they expect to fight. And I think they will put up a bit of resistance against them on that count.
But, you know, as I was watching the people, I said to myself, you know, this reminded me of the response of Haiti in terms of their lack of support for Venezuela. Because as I watched the people and I said to myself, how quickly they have forgotten the good times under Chavez and Maduro. How quickly they forget. It wasn't that long ago. It was recent. And that they were so disloyal and able to just literally, you know, turn on him at the drop of a dime without thinking, without hearing him and without listening and internalizing and understanding that this has nothing to do with Maduro, that this is outside external forces designed to destabilize them.
That's correct. Thank you so much for your call today, and thank you for your contribution. All right, we move on to one subject. I think we can cover one more before our time is up today. And I wanted to ask about the church. We come back to it because now we're hearing even the Pope's right-hand man has been dragged into this massive web of sexual abuse of children in the Catholic Church. And we still don't have that central question addressed. Do you remember the central question that we were looking for to be addressed by the church? It just completed a major convocation of its dioceses all over the world. And it absolutely refused to address this simple question. And I've been talking about it for years. Do you remember what that question was? Edgewater, E from Edgewater, you're on the air.
Yes, hi, Latrice. Thanks for taking the call. Fortunately, I was going to comment about maybe Maduro's involved in it just as much as all the other players are, and it's just a big game on the people of Venezuela, and they're going to be manipulated just like the Haitian people were, and the Yemen people were, and the Libyan people were, and the Syrian people were.
And, the
American people, especially, yeah, because we seem to be the ones that are least informed about the truth, and we're just going along with everything we're being told by the crooked
okay,
media.
So here, I just want to get this at least a few words about this issue developing and has been developing for many, many years now in the Catholic Church. It refuses to recognize that sexual abuse is a crime. It is not a spiritual matter. And it might be a spiritual matter, but secondarily so. Sexual abuse is and has been and continues to be a criminal act. But we find the church deciding that it doesn't need any criminal investigation. Instead, it thinks it can convert people who commit these acts, or it can set in place some kind of spiritual response to what is patently a criminal act. Why is the church, in your view, reluctant to deal with this particular question for all these years, decades? It will not deal with it.
Yep, because they depend on people's perception of them being these holier than thou than we are, and that they have all this power because we went along with this stuff for the last hundreds and hundreds of years and allowed them to get all this power and gold and money. And it's more of a disgrace. That's more of an abomination, as these people are supposed to be upholding to God's law to help people and to take care of children, and they're the ones that are abusing children more than other regular citizens. And what's going on? It's going on. It's something that's so hard to even discuss because of the disgracefulness of it all. And
now,
of course,
I'm going to ask you. This has been going on for decades and decades.
Right.
With the prospect that it will continue to go on for decades and decades without a proper response, what do you think the response ought to be to compel the church to understand that it is aiding and abetting and covering up serious crimes, especially against children, but across the board?
Yeah, this should be an outcry from people everywhere. They should be out in the streets protesting that this is ridiculous what's going on. How come nobody is doing anything about it? It's been going on for decades and decades. I remember back in the 70s, they prosecuted a few priests in the United States that were abusing children. They found that they were abusing, but it's rampant. It's everywhere in every facet of life. Teachers do it. Everybody's doing these things to children. It's something that's coming out of the Bible. It's a biblical prophecy that's coming true. What should be done? I don't understand why nothing's being done.
What ideas do you have that you think would give some kind of speed on this question for a response, a proper response, not just by the church, but the global law enforcement community, since the church has had more than enough time to respond appropriately, it isn't. Then what else could there be to compel the church to obey the laws of the different countries where you have so much suffering going on?
Yeah, it should be happening definitely in Italy anyway, but we're not in Italy. I don't know what the people are doing over there where the Vatican is, but there should be trials set up like they did with the Nazis and put these priests on trial. They shouldn't be upheld above the law. It's totally a egregious thing that's going on. There should be at least some kind of something getting started where they put them on trial and find if they've really committed these acts against children, then they should have to go to jail for it and suffer the consequences for what they did. But how do you do that, Beatrice? It's easy for me to say that, but how does that get done? You know, that's the big question here, and it doesn't seem like anybody has an answer, and I certainly don't, but that's my opinion on it. There should be something done, something like that. But I'm not seeing anything like that.
I don't disagree at all. I think, though, there is, and you're right, there are obstacles that have to be overcome, legal obstacles. And essentially, they deal with who, because the Vatican is its own country. The Vatican is a country, a sovereign state.
Right.
Who or what authority exceeds the Vatican in anything legal where action is required? And is it because there are laws on the books and people are reluctant to change those laws based on that would regulate the power of the church? The church is acting as a legal entity, adjudicating for itself what happens to people who commit these crimes, or even if they should hear these crimes, or how do they decide to dismiss these crimes. So I think that there should be a world summit. The Catholic Church is not the only such entity, religious entity, that is insulated, and they've been successfully insulated against any attempt to regulate them, but they won't do it themselves. So we have to find some kind of a way here in which, because they so adamantly refuse to regulate themselves within what people would say is a fair law, then how do you take that responsibility over? You have a short answer.
Well, one thing I would say is that the people, there has to be ethical priests and nuns in the world that exist, and they should be the ones speaking out in this, because
This is the thing. We have priests who are speaking out. You have nuns who are speaking out because they, too, have been victims of sexual abuse and sexual assault. But we don't see anything beyond the fact that they come forward and complain. The Pope knows it because they have written to him. They have pleaded with him. to help with this issue, and it's not forthcoming. Well, that brings us to the end of our program today. I thank you so much for contributing and helping us get an appreciation of hidden aspects of stories that they tell us every day. And the assumption is, well, they're telling us the news. They're telling us everything that we need to know. Obviously not. We convene again tomorrow, same bad time, same bad channel, as it used to say. Thank you so much for listening today. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.